ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavad Gita, as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, Chapter 1, Text 44. Aho Bata Mahat Papam Kartam Vyavasitaha Vayam Yat Raja Sukha Lobhena Hantum Swajanam Udyataha Ahobata Mahat Papam Kartum Vyavasita Vayam Yat Raja Sukha Lobhena Hantung svajana mudyataha Aho bata mahat papam Kartum vyavesita vayam Yad raja sukha lobhena Hantung svajanam udyataha Translation. Alas, this is Arjuna speaking. Alas, how strange it is that we are preparing to commit greatly sinful acts. Driven by the desire to enjoy royal happiness, we are intent on killing our own kinsmen. Purport, driven by selfish motives, one may be inclined to such sinful acts as the killing of one's own brother, father, or mother. There are many such instances in the history of the world. But Arjuna, being a saintly devotee of the Lord, is always conscious of moral principles and therefore takes care to avoid such activities. Ahobata mahat papam kartam vyavasita vayam yad raja sukha lobhena Hantum Swajanam Udyataha. It is a discussion of moral principles. So here it's discussing morals. We don't discuss morals that much, do we? Do you? Do we discuss morals much? I suppose among Christians it would be more. I mean, Christians are actually somewhat serious about what they're doing, that they'll discuss morals more than we do in Krishna consciousness, in our attempts to be Krishna conscious. Basically, all our morals get condensed into Krishna te kila cheshta, everything we do for the satisfaction of Krishna. And all morality and immorality is relative to that. However, Srila Prabhupada wanted his disciples to be the leaders of the world, moral leaders, or to give guidance to society as brahmanas. So there are many questions that arise that devotees are supposed to give answers to, and it's not always very easy. Just like the instance of Arjuna, what he's saying, that it's not right to kill or attempt to kill one's gurus, one's brothers, one's cousins, well-wishers, all kinds of people who are dear and bound by kinship, were on the other party, and Arjuna's duty was to try to kill them. So Arjuna's protest against fighting seemed to be on solid grounds, and up to the present time, many people have difficulty in, if you just think about it, in accepting the message of Bhagavad Gita. The whole message of Bhagavad Gita was for Krishna, he was convincing Arjuna to fight and kill, and Arjuna was saying, no, it's wrong to fight and kill. And Krishna won the argument, and Arjuna fought and killed. So these are the kind of questions that arise in a consideration of morals. If we study the, I was just talking about Christians, and of course the Western civilization has been much formed by Christianity. But if we study the teachings of Christ, we won't find much that justifies violence. There's one instance we know of Jesus becoming very angry with the merchants in the temple. Otherwise, the more famous instruction of Jesus is that if someone slaps you on one cheek, you give the other cheek for him to slap. Later, St. Augustine, as he's called, Srila Prabhupada didn't have a good opinion of him at all. He's completely speculated that there's no such thing as... He called reincarnation, the idea, ridiculous. But he introduced into Christianity the concept of moral or justified war. And so much has been justified on the basis of that ever since in the name of Christianity. And it's going on to the present day, even though it's not done in the name of Christianity. Nowadays it's done in the name of humanitarianism. Those poor people in the Middle East are sitting on top of all that oil which we Americans need, and so it's in the name of humanitarianism, they need a few bombs on their head so we can get their oil. Well, they don't say like that, but they say it's in the name of humanitarianism. And Bhagavad Gita also, it's justified war. Krishna gave justification for fighting. What about the examples that are given in the purport? That Srila Prabhupada writes that there are many instances in history of people out of selfish motives killing their brother, father, or mother. Killing the brother, in Indian history, apart from Bhagavad Gita, the most famous example of that is Aurangzeb the Great. He was great in some ways. Killing the father. Can you think of any instances of killing the father offhand? Need some historians around here. Killing the mother, that doesn't seem... Caesar? Caesar was killed by his friends. Brutus and company. A two Brutus. Famous line. Whether he actually said that or not, we don't know, but said to have said it. killing one's mother. Could killing one's mother ever be justified? I can't think of any instance of that offhand. I mean, you hear of people killing their mother because they're addicted to drugs and they want to get the money. Or there may be instances of killing their parents to get the inheritance. One particular instance I can think of is Parashuram, who was ordered by his father to kill his mother, and he did so. Because he knew that his father had the yogic power to bring his mother back to life. So he didn't want to disobey his father. But what a strange, unwelcome order to kill your own mother. Could it ever be justified? Could we think of, let's do some theoreticizing here. Could anyone think of any instance in which it would be justified to kill one's own mother? If we could think about it, if she, for instance, she was gone crazy on drugs and started killing her own, your siblings, your brothers and sisters, then maybe in that circumstance, you try to restrain her, you might kill her? Doesn't seem very likely. In what circumstances would it be morally acceptable to kill someone? That raises questions of capital punishment. There are textbooks examples in study of ethics and philosophy, such as, what if, for instance, if you're crossing over a bridge and you see that train underneath on the railway track, some wagons are rolling out of control downhill, and some children are playing on the track, they seem to be unaware of it, and there's a fat man on the bridge, and you think if you just push him, you don't have any time to think about it, if you push him, he'll just land and stop the wagons rolling. So is it morally justifiable to kill? It's a very theoretical example, but it is, as I say, a textbook example. Is it morally justifiable to kill that man to save the life of several children? Another example. Someone comes into a hospital for a general checkup. You happen to know that he has no family, no friends. He's not a bad person, but he has no one in this world to live for. He's quite old, but he's in good health. Meanwhile, in the hospital, there are three people with extensive families who depend on them, who are all of the same blood group. One is dying because he needs a heart attack, one needs a liver transplant, one needs a heart transplant, one needs a liver transplant, and one needs kidney transplant. So is it justified to kill the man who has no friends, no family, no one dependent on him? Is it justified to kill him to save the lives of three other people who are much more needed in the world? These are the kind of moral questions that arise in the rare thing called philosophy classes. It's a question of morality. What is morality? It's relative, isn't it? Is it relative? Well, especially it seems at the present time, it is. It seems to be considered relative. And that's why we hear non-judgmentalism. Don't judge others, because everything's all relative, and there are different values that different people have, and we're not supposed to follow any one standard of morality. And even criminals have their rights. There was a case in England fairly recently of an elderly man. He apprehended a burglar who had entered his house, and the elderly man killed the burglar, and then the elderly man got arrested for murder. What is right for one person is wrong for another. Is that possible? Is it right for one person? Is morality just self-defined? An example of this is that not so long ago, pretty much all over the world, homosexuality was considered immoral. And the situation has changed so much that it's now immoral and illegal. It's considered reprehensible, and it's actually illegal to criticize homosexuality. So that's a moral judgment. Homosexuality was considered immoral because it's unnatural. It was considered unnatural. And now it's considered, well, if it's two consenting adults and they don't harm anyone, why should you Why should you get on their case? So there's no standard authority. In the idea is that there should be no standard authority, but that's considered the overriding moral principle in the world today. If people are not doing harm to others, then let them do whatever they like. That's applied in sex, but then it's not that people are allowed to, in most countries still, they're not allowed to smoke marijuana. Not allowed in this country. Is it illegal? Must be illegal in this country. In most countries. In Holland it's allowed. And in some states of the USA I believe it's allowed. So people, they're not doing any harm to others. They may be doing harm to themselves. It may harm their brain. But it's not allowed. Whereas smoking tobacco is allowed. And that's also very harmful. So one's considered wrong and the other is considered okay, acceptable. What's the standard of morality? Bhagavad Gita presents a standard of morality based in spiritual understanding. What's the ultimate principle? What is the principle whereby Arjuna, who put very good arguments, it seemed that we shouldn't kill or even attack our people who are very dear to us or very closely related to us. It'll cause so much chaos in society if the whole Kshatriya race, who are the protectors of society, if they're all killed. Seem to be very good arguments, but there was one overriding principle, which is Savadhaman Parittajamamekam Sharanam Vraja. That is the foundation of all morals, that Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the ultimate arbitrator of law. Dharmang tu sakshad bhagavat pranitam. Dharma, which this word may be translated in many ways. One way is morality, another way is law. There's not that big divide between morality and law in the Vedic culture. Morality and law mean, morality means you have to follow it. It's not self-defined, not user-defined. So dharma is that which is directly enunciated by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, to understand this, one has to understand its spiritual basis, its basis in understanding what is the ultimate good for all people. This example I gave of the man without any relatives or friends, is it morally acceptable to kill him so you can farm his organs for the benefit of others? So this example is raised as an objection to the philosophy of utilitarianism, raised by Jeremy Bentham, of all people, who his idea, and it sounds very good, is that all action, everything in society should be directed toward the greatest good, the greatest happiness of the greatest number of people. So in the case of theoretical case of killing the man so you can get his organs, it's for the greater good of a greater number of people that this one man be killed. But is it acceptable morally? The Germans, they were more populous than the Jews, and they decided that it's more beneficial to us if the Jews are killed. Is it morally justifiable? Doesn't seem to be. It isn't. But what is the greatest good for every living being? And that, of course, opens the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam. What is the highest good for everyone? And again, we get the word dharma. Savaipung sangparo dharma yato bhaktirat hokshaje ahaitukya pratihata yayatma supersedati. And in this verse, Srila Prabhupada translates the words dharma as occupational duty. In other words, it's not a dharma is often translated as religion, but in this instance, Srila Prabhupada translates it as occupational duty, which is a term he uses in relation to the varnashram system. Everyone has their occupational duty, but it means that he translates this occupational duty, in other words, is not simply a religious belief, but it is how one should live and act in this world. What is the highest dharma for everyone? How should everyone live and act in this world? There are different occupational duties for brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, shudras, brahmacharis, grihasthas, vanaprasthas, sannyasi, and women. And there are different strictures for different classes of people. But for everyone, the highest dharma is bhakti, devotional service to the transcendent Lord, which is unmotivated and uninterrupted. And why is it the highest for every living being? Well, what does everyone want? Happiness. So actual happiness comes from serving Krishna without any motivation, without any holidays, a pratihata, without any tea breaks. Ahaitukya pratihata, yayatma supersedati. That will give full satisfaction, complete satisfaction to the soul. So that is the real need of everyone. And on this understanding, we can next examine the question of morality. Otherwise, if morality is user defined, then it comes down to might is right. That's the actual morality of the world. Who's got strength, they dominate others. That's the way the world goes on. It's not out of consideration of love for others. Here's an interesting point. Who wants to be moral and good? Well, most people would say moral, and most people would say, yeah, I'm moral, I'm good. But according to the Sri Upanishad, everyone's a thief. What do you think if you go and knock on the door and say, my dear sir, I'm going to give you a book which tells you that you're a thief. You're a thief, right? They'd be highly insulted. They might even call the police. They might even punch you in the face. I don't know what they do in this country, but it's unpredictable. It's unpredictable because it's highly unexpected. But that you just walk up to him and say you're distributing books, and then when you're distributing books, I don't know why. I haven't done street book distribution for a long, long time in the West or anywhere. But we used to say, "Oh, what are you doing? What do you do for a living?" One time in Dublin and Ireland, when I asked someone, "What do you do for a living?" he said, "I'm a thief," which is in Irish English, "I'm a thief." I said, "He didn't tell me I'm a thief." Didn't look like he was very successful because he was pretty run down in his looks. But if you say, "Oh, you're a film star, aren't you?" "Oh, who thinks I'm a film star?" They become flattered. Yeah. What do you do for a living? You're a thief, aren't you? Most people wouldn't be very happy. But then the Upanishad begins, Ishava Semidam Sarvam Yatkincha Jagatyang Jagatena Tyaktena Bhunjita Magriha Kasya Sviddhanam. Don't take more than you require. God has given all that we need. Don't take more. Otherwise, we become a thief. Indirectly, is calling everyone a thief. because everything belongs to God. We can use what we are allotted. Don't take more. Or even if we take just what we need, still we shouldn't think, it's mine. Everything belongs to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is Ishavasya. This is morality with the understanding that everything is under the control of the Supreme Lord. It's a completely different take or perspective on morality than that in the secular world. This is a question which a few years ago this Richard Dawkins and others were on a big campaign to atheize the world, to make everyone an atheist. And one of these standard questions that was, or anti-atheistic questions that were lobbed back at him, as he was lobbing all kinds of atheistic arguments at the theists, is that, well, without understanding or belief in God, then there's no morality. Because if you say that, well, everything's just a bunch of atoms, or if you want to get more deeper, everything is just waves, and everything's just matter interacting in different ways, then where's the question of morality? If we say that everything is just chemicals, then what's the harm if one mass of chemicals attacks another mass of chemicals? One mass of chemicals called a human attacks another mass of chemicals called a human and slits the throat. Anyway, you slit the throat means blood comes out. It's all chemicals, right? And if someone dies, well, it's just a transformation of chemicals from one state to another. Richard Dawkins' answer to that is that, yeah, we can work out morality ourselves without resort to religion. We don't need religion. But then it's actually an unanswered question. Where is the morality unless there's an ultimate standard? The question of good and bad arises when we accept that there is more to existence than simply chemicals. Otherwise, if we say, if we burn magnesium, then the magnesium is finished. It oxidizes, becomes magnesium oxide. So you may say, we'll kill the magnesium. You didn't kill it, you just burned it, that's all. So what's the harm? Or you burn a piece of wood and it becomes ashes. You destroyed the wood. So what? But then if you pour kerosene over a human and set their clothes on fire and then the person burns to death, what's the difference? What's the difference between burning a piece of wood and burning a living human being to death? Why, where's the good and where's the bad if it's all just chemical? So actually, even to think of morality, even to think of good and bad, it brings in a metaphysical judgment. Now, in this secular world we live in, secular, usually in the modern world, the word secular, it means atheistic or agnostic. No God, no religion. Well, let's give an example. It's a big issue. Maybe not in this country. In America, America has been culturally divided for almost 50 years. Actually more than that, but since the Roe versus Wade judgment, legalizing abortion in the United States. It's been a big issue between mostly Christians on one side and secularists on the other. Now, what is the question? Both of them feel very strongly about it. One on one side, there's the consideration that you're killing a human. But the pro-choice, there's pro-life versus pro-choice. The pro-choice party will say, well, it's only a potential human. It's not a human yet. At one point, does a fetus become a human? If you say at 3 months, so what happens? Anyway, you don't know exactly the time of impregnation, but saying you know the time of impregnation, or even the time of impregnation is not the time of, what's the word, when the gestation begins, when the semen mixes with the ovum. So even the time of impregnation is a little ahead of that time of the merging of the semen and the ovum. Even if you happen to know the exact time, then okay, 3 months. So does that mean that at 2 months, 29 days, 23 hours, 59 minutes and 59 seconds, it's just a lump of flesh. And then 1 second later, it's a human. You see the ridiculousness of the argument? But they have to arbitrarily decide, 3 months or whatever. Or they say when at the time, that the time, there are different arguments given for when it's a human. When the time when the fetus can be supported outside the womb, and so on and so on and so on. But the idea is, it's a different perspective on morality. One says you're killing a human being. You can't do that. It's murder. And the other side says, well, it's not a human. And then, what about the poor mother? She has to look after the child. It's unwanted child. What about the poor child? Unwanted child. Maybe better you don't allow that mass of matter to become a child. Because if you do, then it'll be an unwanted child. And then if it's an unwanted child, then he'll become a criminal when he grows up. So better just kill him right now. Kill him. Nope, don't kill him. Just abort the embryonic tissue, the fetus. So you can see it's a completely different the perspectives are different because it's a completely different understanding of reality. One understanding of reality, that there is a soul which gives life. The other understanding is that no, matter under certain conditions gives rise to life. So it's not just a moral issue, it's a philosophical and ultimately a spiritual issue. Which is why we as devotees should discuss it. So you may say, well, what's it got to do with my life? I'm sitting here in Zagreb and minding my own business, and what's this talk? It seems to be very theoretical. But if we are to actually take a role as leaders of society, we have to know how to apply the teachings of Bhagavad Gita in every facet of life. Otherwise, it is only theoretical. We should be able to give answers. Devotees should be able to go on TV programs and be asked all kinds of tough questions, moral questions, and moral questions, and actually devotees should be called. The devotees should be seen as authorities because of the devotees' manifest spiritual qualities and spiritual knowledge. They should be asked to give guidance to human society. We have to be ready to do that. But even if we do accept the spiritual dimension, that there is God and we are all subordinate to Him, the moral issues may not be very easy to understand. It's not clear cut. The whole of Mahabharata is one dharma sankat after another. Dharma sankat means a situation in which a person is not sure what to do, and it's a very pressing situation. Just like Arjuna, he was in a situation, if he fights, he thinks it's wrong to fight, and there are very good reasons, apparently, for not fighting. Seems to be very moral not to fight, but on the other hand, there are very pressing reasons why he should fight. He has to support his brother, he has to quell the, in association with his brothers, he has to quell the irreligious forces which are presently ruling the world. If Duryodhana is allowed to get away, as Arjuna proposes, if Arjuna is allowed to get away with his rascaldom, then that'll set a very bad precedent in society. If Arjuna is supposed to be a kshatriya, he's supposed to protect society from adharma. And Duryodhana was the epitome of adharma. So it's a vexed question. It's difficult to say what is the right thing to do. Even if you're very good, as Arjuna is, even if you have only good intentions, as Arjuna had, even if you are conversant with the laws of the scriptures, as Arjuna was, it becomes a very difficult thing to understand. And therefore Arjuna, he became a disciple of Krishna to be instructed in the right thing to do. Interestingly, the Christians who are very much against abortion, they also have no qualms about eating meat and killing animals. You think if they want to do good to others and be nice and be good, if you want to be nice and be good, then why kill animals and why eat meat? But it's enshrined in Christian teachings. Again, get back to Saint Augustine, who says that only humans have souls and animals don't have souls. So it's all right to kill the animals. In fact, you should kill them, otherwise... You must have heard that argument. People say, well, if you don't kill the animals, they'll overrun us. Right? If you don't kill the chickens, there'll be thousands of chickens running around all over the place. We'll be chickenized. We'll be taken over by chickens. If we have to kill them all. There's an Alfred Hitchcock horror movie, The Birds, about, wasn't a very frightening one, but how the birds, they took over humans. They became threatened human society. What is right and what is wrong? Here, how about this one? You've heard of Charles Manson. All heard of Charles Manson. He's well known in California up to the present day. Unfortunately, he was a killer, murderer. He ritually murdered people in some kind of imaginary semi-religious or quasi-religious acts for killing people. And apparently he chanted Hare Krishna also as he did it. But anyway, he thought, I'm doing the right thing because the whole of society is wrong. And so we have to kill the big people in society, the big leaders. If we kill them, it's good because they're all wrong. What do you think of that one? Does it make sense? Well, that's something like Arjuna was doing, but it wasn't. Arjuna was given the task of killing the bad leaders of society because they were acting immorally, so they required to be killed. Of course, Charles Manson's not exactly in the same, not at all in the same category. He didn't have any mandate to do so. To take the law in his own hands. What do you do if there's no morality? With lax morality in society, a very prominent feature of lax morality in society is free sex. What do you think if you're raising children in the modern society and then you can't tell, it's very difficult to tell them. Devotees have this problem all the time who are raising children. It's a great fear of devotees that their children at the age of, who, maybe by latest 12, they'll start experimenting with sex. And it's difficult to tell them, well, we shouldn't do this because it's wrong, when everyone around them, all the other kids are having sex. They might even be having sex with their teachers. You never know. Many years ago, must have been the early 1980s, I was in Denmark and one of our devotees contacted a teacher there, female teacher, and he made her a devotee and he eventually married her, and she told us that in Denmark, this is the early 1980s, it was just a very common thing that the teachers and the children in the school have sex. Why not? They didn't see anything wrong with it. So it's a very difficult society that we're raising children in a society where drugs, sex, violence, they're just all pervading, it seems. It seems to be a very frightening prospect to bring children into this world at all. Morality, be good, feel good. Yeah, we don't hear so much about morality. We hear more things about good vibes, feeling good, be nice to others, all very vague terms. New age spirituality, you just be nice to others, non-judgmentalism. Non-judgmentalism itself leads to immorality because you're not supposed to judge anyone. If there are moral standards, that means there's right and wrong. But then if there's non-judgmentalism, then you're not supposed to say anything is right or wrong. So the whole idea, you shouldn't judge someone, it's wrong to judge anyone. Well, if you say it's wrong to judge anyone, you're immediately making a judgment right there. But the idea, yeah, live and let live, let everyone do whatever they like. Actually, that's allowed in Vedic culture, but within parameters. There are broad parameters. For instance, if people want to eat meat in Vedic culture, they are allowed to, but within parameters. If people want to eat beef, it's allowed in Vedic culture. Yeah, it's allowed. But no cow killing. You want to eat beef, you have to wait for the cow to die. And then you can't accept any position in the higher level of society. Because only people of low consciousness would do that. But it's allowed. Meat eating, animal killing, you want to kill animals? It's allowed in Vedic culture. But under restrictions. It's not meant for the leaders of society, but for people who have that low inclination, there's room to do that, but there's judgmentalism also. And knowing that people who indulge in animal killing under orders or under restrictions, they are in the lower section of society. They cannot be allowed to be the leaders of society. They cannot be the brahmanas who, of course, even brahmanas in previous ages used to kill animals in sacrifice, but then they would bring them back to life again. But killing for the sake of eating is allowed in Vedic culture, but only in the very low levels. But there's, in other words, there is, in Vedic culture, there is a broad allowances for different classes of people, but at the same time, there are rules and there is judgmentalism also. What is good and what is bad? What is higher? What is lower? So it all becomes quite complex. That's why in the Vedic culture is quite complex. We talk about dharma. It can become very complex. What's the right thing to do? Because it takes into account such considerations. What is right to do in a certain situation? It can be elusive. And that's why in Vedic culture, one is supposed to act under the guidance of gurus, not just one guru, but gurus. I mean, the immediate gurus are in the family and in the village, the brahmanas, who instruct what to do under certain situations. What should you do in certain situations? Otherwise, all kinds of things which some people may think is right and some may think is wrong. Who's to say? We have to follow the orders given by God, which are meant for the ultimate benefit of human society. Otherwise, if we think, what's the immediate benefit? Well, let there be abortion, because it's good for the girl. She didn't want the baby, and so it's good for her. But then apart from other considerations, there are considerations of the laws of karma. If you kill, you have to be killed. As Srila Prabhupada said, those who engage in abortion, they will also have to be aborted. They won't see the light of day. They'll be killed. The abortion doctors are in for a very horrible future, because tit for tat. The Vedic culture attempts to maintain peace in society. It's difficult, especially in the age of Kali, which is an age of quarrel, but as far as possible to maintain peace so that people may gravitate toward the highest goal of life, which is to develop love of Krishna. And even though everyone may not be on that level, people should follow these standard laws which prescribe morality and proscribe immorality, so at least so that they won't get degraded. As at the present time in the world, because there's no clear knowledge of what is right and wrong, people tend to do wrong. There's no knowledge of the goal of life. People think that, well, I'm just here. Mostly they don't think at all, but if they're at all, they think, well, I'm just here for a short time in this world, so I have to enjoy myself. At the same time, I should be good and nice and cooperate with others. But that can change very quickly also, this being nice. The average nice person can become very unnice very quickly, as was seen in this country, how long ago? 30 years ago, there was civil war in Yugoslavia, and nice people overnight became just hellish monsters, killing mercilessly in the most cruel ways people who previously would have not thought to do so. But all of a sudden, the Serbs should be killed if you're a Croatian. And if you're a Serb, Croatians should be killed. They don't deserve to be alive. In fact, they don't even deserve an easy death. They deserve to be killed in the most painful manner possible. I don't think anyone philosophically thought about the moral issues concerned. People were just directed to do so by politicians. So that's why, again, we have to have brahmanas in society to give proper guidance. If there were brahmanas, they wouldn't give directions to this person should be killed. Why? Because he's a Serbian. There are no such directions in Vedic culture. Even as there is recognition that there are yavanas, chandalas, mlechas, but they're not to be killed because they're of low habits. So the Vedic culture is actual utilitarianism. I'd mentioned that Jeremy Bentham's idea of utilitarianism, that there should be the greatest good or the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. But the Vedic culture is the best benefit for everyone. Everyone who follows it can be best benefited. Not that everyone will immediately come to the highest level, but even if one is on a low level of consciousness, they are controlled for their own good, and that's something which sounds very horrible to modern people, isn't it? You should be controlled for your own good. No, we should be free, but actually we are controlled for our own good in so many ways. For instance, you have to drive on a certain side of the road and say, well, that just makes sense, but it's a law, and it's for the good of everyone. Because if you don't do that, then for a start, there'll be all kind of traffic jams, there'll be more accidents, and it just makes sense that you follow the laws, the traffic laws, for the greater good of everyone. And that's there are so many laws, and not only laws, but there are also mores or standard norms of, and not legally prescribed but accepted standards of human behavior. So the Vedic culture regulates everyone. There's a lot of regulation, a lot of laws, a lot of rules to keep everyone on the right track. And if necessary, those rules have to be enforced. For the highest class of people, they don't need to be enforced. They're called the brahmanas. And for others, there has to be force to keep them on the proper track. Otherwise, they'll cause problems for them. They'll commit sinful activities, which will cause them to suffer karmic reactions and which will disturb the whole society. And then the whole direction of society, of rising to the higher level of consciousness, ultimately God consciousness, Krishna consciousness, that will all be spoiled if there is turbulence in society. So it's very important to keep peacefulness in society. The Vedic culture is very complex because it wants to keep peacefulness in society with a specific goal, and at the same time taking into consideration that there are different people with different levels of consciousness. So it's, in one sense, it's not immoral for a chandala to kill an animal and eat it, because that's expected for him. But it is immoral for a brahmana to kill an animal just because he wants to eat it. So it is, there is relative morality within Vedic culture, but it is all on an absolute background, that everyone is supposed to be raised to the level of Krishna consciousness. Now, I've given some various apparently extreme examples, just like, could you kill your mother? And the Bhagavad Gita is an extreme example. We don't expect people ever to be put in the situation where would you kill your father or brother? You don't expect to be put in that situation. But we could be at any time, just like that example I just gave of Yugoslavia, where people were killing their own wives. Tito's policy, the Serbs should be married to the Croatians, so we all merged together as Yugoslavs. And someone thought, my wife, she's a Croatian, kill her. My children, they're children of Croatians, kill them all. So it may arise. We don't know. At any time it may arise. We're living in a fairly peaceful situation in the world at the present time, but at any time situations can arise in which we have to make very severe or intense moral judgments about what is right and what is wrong. So what's the standard? The standard is, again, Krishna te kila cheshta, everything we should do ultimately for the pleasure of Krishna. It may be difficult to understand what Krishna wants us to do in a particular situation, just as you find that Arjuna didn't know. He didn't know what to do. He thought he knew what to do. But then when Krishna chastised him, he realized, well, maybe I'm not right after all. It seems to me like I'm right, but Krishna's chastising me like anything, so now I'm bewildered. I thought I knew what was right, but Krishna says it's wrong, so what's going on? And then he asked Krishna to explain that to him. He became Krishna's disciple, but he wasn't fully surrendered because he kept on putting objections until Krishna could fully convince him. It may be that devotees, they're supposed to be acting on the highest platform, but they may still observe worldly morality, at least for the sake of blending in and being accepted in human society. Srila Prabhupada writes in one purport to Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, there are many instances of devotional service rendered by previous acharyas who did not care about social behavior when intensely absorbed in love for Krishna. So in other words, if one is actually on the highest platform of Krishna consciousness, you don't have to follow any rules, any social rules. However, Srila Prabhupada continues, unfortunately, as long as we are within this material world, we must observe social customs to avoid criticism by the general populace. This is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's desire. We should observe social customs. Well, does that mean that devotees have to put these... That's not so much popular now. That was... At one time, that was... It was a social custom among a certain class of people to put bits of iron in their mouth and what do they call that? These punks and all that? Piercing, yeah. Still it goes on, huh? I see shops, ear piercing and tattoos. They put all kinds of things like that. Actually, they're in Vedic culture, but not in such a ghastly, horrific way. There may be nose rings and the earrings and things like that. When Srila Prabhupada was asked in a TV interview in America in 1971, how would I recognize a true follower of the Krishna Conscious Movement by his behavior? Srila Prabhupada answered, he will be a perfect gentleman, that's all. You cannot find any fault in him. So, although devotees in one sense are above all morality, in another sense they act on the highest platform of morality. But it might not always be understood also by the general populace. For instance, if we train our children, or we don't allow our children to watch TV, that may be thought, well, that's terrible. The poor children, they grow up without TV, and we're thinking, phew, saved our children from all those horrible things on TV, which turns them into immoral rascals. So the idea is that, well, we shouldn't unnecessarily disturb people by acting in an immoral or antisocial way. But on the other hand, we can't compromise our principles. It all becomes quite complex. And then we throw in the idea of time, place and circumstance. How we should act according to time, place and circumstance. If we consider the Bhagavad Gita was spoken 5,000 years ago in a time and a culture that is very different from the one we are living in at the present, then how does all this apply here? Gets very complex. Can get very complex, but we don't want to make it unnecessarily complex. Keep the point. We have to please Krishna. What does Krishna want? Well, we can learn that from Srila Prabhupada. We can learn also by studying the pristine Vedic culture, because that is a manifestation of what Krishna wants, how he wants people to live in this world. Srila Prabhupada wanted to introduce Vedic culture. So we can. It's a major part of Srila Prabhupada's disciples and followers. Mandate from him is to re-establish Vedic culture. There may be differences. We are living in different times, so it may not be exactly how exactly we are to practice Krishna consciousness might not be exactly the same as it was in India, say some thousands of years ago. But then in India also, even Vedic culture, it was never monolithic or uniform in all respects. Srila Prabhupada, one of the reasons for his success in bringing Krishna consciousness to the West was that he was able to make adjustments. Not that he compromised, but he was able to make adjustments. At the same time, he repeatedly said that he wanted to introduce the Vedic culture, which means that he made adjustments to the contemporary Western society, understanding that it would be necessary to do so to introduce Vedic culture. At the same time, he was not at all enamored by the Western contemporary society. He called it nonsense civilization, animal civilization, most misdirected civilization. He wasn't at all a fan of the Western civilization, but he did make adjustments to introduce Krishna consciousness in like a needle and out like a plow. That was the idea. So he wanted to introduce this culture based on the philosophical understanding or the ontological understanding that we are all parts and parcels of Krishna. We're suffering in this material world. We don't belong here. We have to live our life aiming at Krishna. Otherwise, all morals, all questions of morality and immorality are meaningless. As Srila Prabhupada sometimes gave the example, what is the question of morality among thieves? A gang raids a house and kills the people and steals all their possessions. Then they get back to their hideout. And then they say, okay, now we have all this, booty. Now we should fairly divide it among ourselves. Very morally, we shall divide it among ourselves. So where's the question of morality among thieves? Their whole basis of everything they're doing is immoral. So if we talk about the morality of Western society, well, it's all based on the secular, materialistic, agnostic or atheistic society. It's all based on the idea of eat, sleep, drink, be merry and enjoy, for tomorrow we shall all be dead. Might makes right. Where's the morality? If the Isha Upanishad intimates that we're all a thief, well, that we're not just thieves, but we're very badly misusing our human life and committing all sinful activities. So how do we do all this? Well, we can see the example of Srila Prabhupada and all the previous acharyas, especially beginning with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who lived in the world, in the modern world. If we think of the late 19th century in which Bhaktivinoda Thakur lived, we may not think, well, that seems very old, but actually it was the beginning of the modern world. That it was the society had very much changed from its old traditional moorings. So they, beginning with Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and Srila Prabhupada, even in his household life, showed how to live in this world while keeping one's focus clearly on Krishna. Padma Patrami Vampasa. Krishna gives the example in Bhagavad Gita of being like a lotus leaf which is on the water, but it doesn't interact with the water. If you put water on a lotus leaf, it won't stay. Kamala dala jala, jivana talamala. It'll fall down. So life is like that also. So the point is that Srila Prabhupada, he lived in this world. He had possessions. He wasn't a greedy person who wanted things for himself. But he had possessions. Was he a thief? No, because he used everything in the service of Krishna. So if we use everything in the service of Krishna, including not only our possessions, but our life, our strength, our thoughts, prana-artha-diyavacha, our very life, our money, our possessions, our intelligence, our words, shreya-acharanam-sada, if we always use whatever Krishna has given us for the highest good for everyone, which means in Krishna consciousness, and that will give us the direction how to live morally in this world. Apart from these, I'm talking about very difficult situations which may arise in human society, but there are some basic moral principles which exalted people follow. That means no meat eating, no gambling, no illicit sex, no intoxication. Actually, Srila Prabhupada said that's the beginning of human life. Not exalted, but considering that the whole of the contemporary civilization is based on meat eating, gambling, intoxication, and illicit sex, then anyone who follows these principles of not indulging in them is very exalted. That's why Srila Prabhupada said, how would you recognize a person in Krishna consciousness? Prabhupada said they're a perfect gentleman. Well, gentleman, and that's an English word. So if you think the English word gentleman, it means he has a suit and tie and eats meat, has illicit sex, gambles, and does everything wrong. So Srila Prabhupada's understanding of gentleman is, according to his definition or the Shastric definition, and we are faced with various moral judgments as individuals and as a society. So we have to see how to ourselves live and give direction. For instance, it's a common question. What do parents do? Okay, my daughter's 14 years old. She wants to wear a miniskirt. Should I allow her or shouldn't I? You may not be able to control her. But should she just be allowed to? With the idea that if you force the children, they may resent it so much that they reject Krishna consciousness? Or do you allow them to indulge in some sense gratification with the idea that if you maintain some friendship with them, then later they may come around and be Krishna conscious? These are real questions which devotees face all the time. What about the question of divorce? We can't even talk about divorce in the West among devotees because so many of them are divorced that it's too sensitive, but it's going on all the time. In what circumstances is it acceptable to divorce? Theoretically, it should be under no circumstances. But then we see in some cases that one of the spouses is adamant to break all the four regulated principles and the other wants to be Krishna conscious. So, quite possibly in such a situation, divorce could be allowed. But it's not. So there are all kinds of questions which they have to be judged individually. But the point is that we have to judge it according to what Krishna wants. We have to know what Krishna wants. Tasmat shastram pramanam te karya karya vevastito. Gyatva shastra vidhanoktam kartam karyam kartamiharhasi. Krishna says at the end of the 16th chapter, in which he largely discusses the demoniac principles of life, Krishna says that one should know what are the principles of morality according to the Shastras and act accordingly. So those who are Brahmanas, supposed to be Brahmanas, Srila Prabhupada wanted to make a class of Brahmanas, they should know what are the Shastric injunctions and follow them and how to apply them. And be wise enough also, discriminating enough to know how to apply them in various circumstances. So in this way, the Brahmana means is supposed to be a guru of society, which means they should be ideal in their behavior, morally ideal. and learned in Shastra and ready to give direction to others. The point is that morality is relative to Krishna, what Krishna wants, or how we should act in such a way that is pleasing to Krishna. That is ultimately morality, as Arjuna found out. He had his own idea of morality. Krishna gave him the proper idea of morality. Therefore, the word dharma sometimes is translated as morality, but it doesn't really fit the word morality, because dharma means something which has to be followed. It has to be followed to be in accordance with Krishna. So it's not exactly morality. The idea of morality is some relative idea. But dharma means relative to Krishna, who is absolute. Hare Krishna. So, any question about that? You're waiting for the microphone. You can tell me and I'll repeat it. And then you're going to bring up all kinds of specific questions. But I was speaking in a general way. How to apply it specifically? That we have to see. I'm just giving the general background there. There are unlimited individual cases. That's why Shastra does not give a rule for every situation, because there are unlimited situations with unlimited nuances. And it's not possible to give a Shastric direction for every single nuanced situation. And even a particular nuanced situation that can be liquid, it can change also. So one has to know Shastra and the principles of Shastra and how to apply it. Tasmat shastram pramanam te karya karyo vyavastito gyatva shastra vidhano tam kartam karyam eharhasi.
I just want to hear from you your advice, because sometimes devotees in the name of preaching.
Preaching is the excuse, right? Preaching is the essence. Preaching is the excuse. In the name of... Yeah, there are two main ways I see in which there's so much compromise within ISKCON today. One thing is in the name of time, place and circumstance, which is valid when properly applied, but when not properly applied, it's an excuse. And the other thing is it's good for the preaching. And all kinds of wild and wonderful things get introduced in the name, it's good for the preaching.
More specifically, devotees sometimes go to traveling to share books, and they often say, so we share books, we can take karmi food, karmi bread.
When you go for selling books, you can eat karmi food.
Sorry?
When you go for books, selling books and traveling sankirtan, you can eat karmi bread. Is it? Where did you get that from?
We don't follow this principle, but
someone may say, but then you have to understand from Shastra what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said. Bishayir onna kaile molin hoiman. One's mind becomes contaminated by eating food from non-devotees. So in one sense, if you're preaching, you can do anything, but then you have to see how strong we are. Hanuman burned Lanka. That's not generally a good thing to do, is it? To go in a place and burn it down. Hanuman, he can do it. Physically he could do it, and morally he could do it, because he did it for the pleasure of Lord Rama. Otherwise, just to go in and burn a city down, that's not for everyone. Srila Prabhupada said about Jesus Christ, when he was told that Jesus Christ ate meat, and Srila Prabhupada said he could eat the whole world. He's a powerful devotee, but that's not meant to be the example for everyone. in all times, places and circumstances. So yeah, sincerity is required. If we're insincere, then we have no hope anyway. We can justify all kinds of things. In my heart, Krishna told me to fill in the dotted line, whatever nonsense you want to. That's another thing. In my heart, I feel. But we're not told in, Shastra doesn't tell us to, in our heart, feel something, because our heart is full of lust, greed, anger, and so many bad things. So we have to take direction from Shastra, not from what's in our heart. Anything else? Yeah, okay, please say. I'll repeat it anyway because
one point
the recording.
You mentioned that wasn't always monolithic.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
It wasn't always monolithic religions or
Vedic culture, not monolithic. No,
so I was just wondering if you can share your opinion.
Share how Vedic culture is not monolithic? Well, there are different rules and regulations and norms for Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, Brahmanas. Then brahmacharis, grihasthas, vanaprasthas, sannyasis. For women there are different rules. For there are subcastes in different regions. People may follow things differently. There are different dharma shastras for different times and ages. There's so many varieties. At the same time, it's recognizable as one culture, which is nowadays called Hindu culture. It's a long way from pristine Vedic culture, but it is recognizable as a culture, as a distinct culture, distinctly different from Muslim culture, Jewish culture, or whatever. But it's not homogeneous or monolithic.
ISKCON, that the parents would complain and go on television and, you know.
That came up recently, that there was a TV program in Delhi, in Hindi, in which they brought a sobbing mother and said, "Oh, my boy, he joined ISKCON." And there was, and what do you call that? The anchor was trying to make it look like the devotees were really bad for preaching and making young men into brahmacharis. I would have said to that guy, "You don't give a damn. You're just doing this to make a controversy because it's good. Then you get TV ratings and you get more money. You're a hypocrite," I would have said to him. One of our devotees, brahmachari, who there was a series of counter videos made by ISKCON devotees. One of them was a devotee. He was giving a. There was a video of him giving a talk to students, and one of the students says, "What does your mother think about you joining this organization?" And then he said, "Okay, I'll ask her." And he phoned her up and said, "Hey, Matt, I'm giving a talk to 200 students here about the principles of Bhagavad Gita. What do you think?" And she said, "I'm very proud of you," and this and that. So, anyway, these things come and go. They're, at least in India, I find that in many cases, the parents, they don't like if their son becomes a brahmachari. After some time, they get used to it and then they become proud of it in many cases, and they often become devotees themselves. Anyway, this has been going on at least since the time of Hiranyakashipu, that parents don't like their children becoming devotees. Yeah, you have a question?
I have a question regarding Queen Kunti. class?
Yes, about Murali.
What about Sati? That Madhuri, there was a Madhuri died in the fire. How about that? When Pandu died? Immoral. Different understanding altogether. That when the body dies, the soul doesn't die. That's why it seems to me that in India in general, people they're not so much disturbed by death as in the West, or even by some accident or something like that. Say if your leg gets crushed in an accident, people tend to be more stoic, thinking, well, anyway, it's some previous life I did something, and then anyway, it's just one life. Mm. Yeah, go on. We take Queen Kunti as a role model for devotees, in some ways. Not for everyone, in all ways.
Yes, because there's a seemingly contradictory act that she did, and this is abandoning her child.
Abandoning her child, yeah. Yeah, well, she's not praised for that. She abandoned her first child. She's not praised for that. We don't find any Acharya has said that following the example of Kunti, every woman should abandon her first child. Yeah, well, the Mahabharata is full. As if Mahabharata, the whole Mahabharata from beginning to end is Dharma Sankata.
It's
Ramayana also.
It's on parts.
Ramayana also. What should Ram do? Should he? His father wants him to stay and be the king, but he disobeyed his father. He obeyed his father, and then his father changed his mind and said, no, I have to follow the order. I have to do what you said. I can't change it now. So it's full of all things like that. The first, in the case of Krishna and Rama, the first demon they killed were both women. How about that? You're not supposed to kill women, but they did. And Ram asked about that when Vishwamitra said, hey, you kill this demon. Here's a woman. And then he gave some example from ancient history. At that time it was ancient history. How you, just like in the law court, you have to refer to a previous case. And then so, yeah, okay, then he did it. Yeah, go on.
It's about Brahmanas. I don't exactly remember where it is. It's difficult because I don't have this verse in front of me. But I remember, I think in part when was Ram going to a forest and
everyone following him.
Ram was going to the forest and the whole population of Ayodhya followed him. And then he abandoned them. He tricked them and left them. So, moral or immoral, or what's going on?
In one moment they said that little by little people started going back home, and one of them, the first starting going home, Brahmanas who eat meat.
Brahmanas who eat meat, yeah? There are Brahmanas who eat meat.
Can you explain that? Because you just now said before that
Brahmanas... Yagya Shishta. That which is there in the yajna, brahmanas may do. It's allowed. not recommended for this age, but it was allowed in previous ages. Yeah.
So short to die, and they sacrifice some animal.
I'm not sure exactly what happens. It says they get a new body, but I guess the old body must still be there. But that was ended by Buddha, wasn't it? Because people were using the sacrifices as an excuse to kill animals and eat them. Yeah, it's there. We find in the Bhagavatam that, what is it, Vātapi and Ilvala, they used to call brahmanas and feed them with meat and then kill them in that way. One of them, Vātapi would take the form of a ram and be cut up, and then the other one, or Ilvala, and then he would call, come out, and then he'd come out of his body tear the stomach of the person to pieces. But then Agastya immediately digested him, and then he was finished. So that's human sacrifice is also there in the Bhagavatam, you may remember. Shunashepa.
Slaves.
Hmm?
Slaves.
Slaves, yeah. Slaves, yeah, that was everywhere. But then they're not. But the slaves means like Shudras. But they're treated well also. Many people in the world today might be better off if they were under control. So they weren't allowed to take drugs and drink wantonly. They were controlled, they have work, they have food. Even some people, not only in Vedic culture, they'd voluntarily become slaves. So they get a fixed residence, they get fixed food, and even the master may arrange for their marriage, because he wants the next generation, the master's children should also have slaves. So for someone who has no means of livelihood, they may voluntarily become a slave. It's only when it becomes such a horrific thing as in the slave trade from Africa to the Americas, then that becomes really inhuman. Otherwise, slavery may not be such a bad thing. I don't think we should preach that generally in the world today at the present moment. But if you think about it, it makes sense, doesn't it? What's better, to be a vagabond in the street? Just like in America now, there are maybe tens of thousands of homeless people. No job, no means of income, no home. Completely useless life. What would be better if they have a kind or master who they have to work and they get their food, they get clothing, they get all their necessities taken care of. But they don't have independence to do whatever they like, because they're not intelligent enough to properly use that opportunity. It's a very different perspective on life altogether. Western civilization has failed. Time to try something else. You may say, well, ISKCON has failed in so many ways, failed to institute Prabhupada's ideas of Varnashram. ISKCON suffers from the same disease. Yeah, well, the same disease is divorce, and devotees fall down into drugs and so many things. Yeah, but we're actually supposed to be showing a better civilization. ISKCON's failures are largely because we haven't taken up this mission to give an alternative society. We're trying to live half as demons, half following we're following the contemporary civilization and trying to be Krishna conscious at the same time. It doesn't work, because the contemporary civilization is based on sense gratification and Krishna consciousness is based on sense control. Hare Krishna. We'll finish there. It's almost time for the arati. Vancha kalpa tarupyas chakripa sindhu vyavacha putitanam pavadebhyo. Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha.